Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Working from home? Conference calls?
You're still on mute, John.
With everything we have going on right now, it's never been more important to get the sleep we need. Quality sleep is a natural immune booster, and only the Sleep Number 360 smart bed senses your movements and automatically adjusts your comfort and support on both sides, your Sleep Number setting. So, all those other things we're doing to stay healthy and happy, well, they'll work better too. And now, during the lowest prices of the season, the Queen Sleep Number 360 C4 smart bed is only $12.99. Save $400, only for a limited time. To learn more, go to sleepnumber.com.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday the 22nd of June, these are our main stories. Afghanistan says last week was the deadliest for its armed forces in the last 19 years. Students in France are now all required to return to school as the government further eases coronavirus restrictions. A COVID-19 tennis row in Serbia involving the world number one Novak Djokovic. Also in this podcast, we go to Brazil, only the second country after the US to have more than 50,000 deaths from coronavirus.
Brazil was one of the last countries to have the disease. We had time to prepare, but we didn't do. We are seeing the curve to going up and not to going down.
And Mysterious Money, a financial technology company in Germany, says more than $2 billion missing from its accounts probably never existed. Afghanistan was supposed to be in a state of relative calm at the moment. The United States and the Taliban signed a peace deal earlier this year. Instead, Kabul says last week was the deadliest in the country in 19 years. This is what the US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called for at the end of February.
First, keep your promises to cut ties with Al-Qaeda and other terrorists. Keep up the fight to defeat ISIS. Welcome the profound relief of all Afghan citizens, men and women, urban and rural, as a result of this past week's massive reduction in violence, and dedicate yourselves to continued reduction.
But since that agreement, Afghan security officials say that they've been targets of Taliban violence and that nearly 300 of their members have been killed in more than 400 different attacks. A spokesman for the Taliban says those claims are propaganda to disrupt the peace process. Our correspondent Sukunda Kamani told me more.
Afghan officials say it's been a particularly deadly week of violence. As you say, 291 members of the security forces killed in over 400 attacks in provinces across the country. Now, casualty figures are difficult to verify and are often disputed in Afghanistan. In fact, for quite a few years, the Afghan government weren't releasing regular data on just how many members of the security forces are being killed because the figure is so high. So it's hard to say whether this is indeed the deadliest week in the conflict, as is being claimed by Afghan officials. But we do know that tens of thousands of members of the security forces are killed every year, as are thousands of civilians. And it's likely, I think, that the government are releasing these figures now to pressurise the Taliban ahead of the possible start of negotiations between the two sides, particularly, as you say, because the Taliban seem to have agreed to an unofficial reduction in violence last month that was meant to be in place leading up to the start of these talks.
Sure, those elusive face-to-face talks were supposed to be part of that deal that was signed back in February. What chance is there of them happening now?
Yes, exactly. In February, the United States and the Taliban signed an agreement setting out the timetable, or a provisional timetable, for the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan. The next stage in the peace process was meant to be these direct negotiations between the Taliban and the Afghan government, something that hasn't happened so far. Now, they've been delayed. They were meant to take place in March. They've been delayed over a dispute about a prisoner exchange plan. The Taliban want 5,000 of their prisoners released before those talks start. The government had been resisting that. Now, over the last month, there has been quite a lot of progress with more and more prisoners being released on both sides. But the Afghan government has said this continued violence casts a shadow over the Taliban's commitment to peace. And Taliban, as you say, refuted the government's figures. They say they've been acting defensively for the most part. But I think the crucial thing to understand about the Taliban's continued violence here is that they don't want to declare a ceasefire too early in the negotiation process as they see it, because that, for the violence for them, is their biggest form of leverage. On the ground, of course, that means that fighting continues, and all of this amidst a global pandemic, which Afghanistan has not been spared from.
There are plenty of warnings about the impact COVID-19-related school closures are having on the mental health of children around the world. Hundreds of millions of kids are stuck at home, but from today, not in France. In fact, parents now are obliged to send them to school, causing, as we'll hear in a moment, a degree of concern about how safe they'll actually be. The easing of the lockdown there now extends to swimming pools and cinemas being reopened. The actress Emmanuelle Devaux said it was a relief to be back.
First of all, from a personal point of view, I miss not being able to present a film under normal conditions. And then to find myself in a cinema, it's such a normal thing. But to be deprived of it for 3 months, I personally suffered.
Catherine Gilliardi is a journalist in Paris. She told me more about the obligatory return to school across the country.
The social distancing measures are totally gone for the youngest kids, so under 6 years old. But for the others, teachers are saying that it's not sure that they'll be able to make the children respect this distancing while they're playing together in the yard, in the courtyard, and also putting back the tables next to each other. So yes, lots of parents are not very happy to send their kids back. And I have to say, being a parent myself, not only a journalist, I'm sending back my son, who's 14, so he's the eldest. I mean, basically it's from 3 to 14-year-old children going back to school. He will only go 2 hours a day. We don't really know what's the point. He's giving back his books today. It's the end of term, or it's the end of the year, actually, in 2 weeks. Yeah. 2 hours a day for 4 days, so he will go back to school 8 hours a week. We don't really know what he's going to do, and that's also what lots of parents are saying, as the youngest mostly do sports or play. Mm-hmm. So really, I mean, the agenda is to bring people back to work.
Catherine, you were mentioning it's the end of term now. Another important change today is the fact that holiday centres are opening. I suppose that speaks to the fact that there's a real economic necessity now to get the country back to some kind of normality, particularly now that the holidays are coming. People need to earn money over that period.
Yes, indeed. I mean, this is the number one priority, and this is what we heard when Emmanuel Macron, our president, last week said, you know, it's compulsory to go back to school. It's an economic question, going back to work. And indeed, the tourist sector, as everywhere in the world, has suffered a lot. France is a very touristic place, and French people are expected to travel in France this year, but we're hoping that it's going to open to Europeans at least. But indeed, yeah, it's really a matter of economics.
That was Catherine Gilliardi. Well, in Germany, the coronavirus R factor, or reproduction rate, has risen sharply. To contain the virus, it should be less than one, but over the last few days, that value has risen sharply and is now 2.88. But officials say that this doesn't necessarily mean Germany is seeing a second wave of infections, as our correspondent in Berlin, Damien McGuinness, explains.
This sudden rise in the coronavirus R factor in Germany is mainly down to a number of localised outbreaks. More than 1,300 workers at a meat processing plant have tested positive for COVID-19. And in Berlin and the town of Göttingen, whole apartment blocks have been quarantined after residents were infected. So far, there's no sign that Germany is seeing a second wave. Because the country's overall infection rate is low, these sudden local outbreaks have a big impact on the national R number. They've so far been contained and don't appear to be causing more infections. And 140 local authorities haven't seen any new cases at all in the past 7 days. But the drastic measures to contain the outbreaks have a cost. People's homes have been fenced off, with police preventing residents from going outside.
Meanwhile, the coronavirus situation in Brazil continues to worry many people. The country now has had more than a million infections. Many experts fear Brazil's true numbers are higher because of a lack of testing, and they warn that the outbreak's peak is still to come. Our South America correspondent Katie Watson reports from Sao Paulo.
Uma gripezinha It was just a little cold, said Brazil's president, when the crisis started. And even as infection soared and the death toll climbed, Jair Bolsonaro carried on. I'm no gravedigger, he quipped in April, as he was questioned over the numbers. A week later, he was taken to task again. So what, he shrugged. I'm no miracle worker.
My central nucleus of my family was completely destroyed.
Seven members of Douglas Sturtz's family got COVID-19. His mother and uncle passed away in the hospital where he works as a trainee surgeon. His grandmother also died. He was the only one to attend his mother's funeral. The entire family was quarantined.
Just me and myself. And it's the worst thing ever. Because you have nobody to cry with you. You have nobody to give a hug.
So what does he make of Brazil's crisis?
Brazil was one of the last countries to have the disease. We had time to prepare, but we didn't do. We are seeing the curve to going up and not to going down. So we could change it, but we didn't do.
Do you think Bolsonaro is responsible?
He have his own part of guilty in this, sure. We need a leader, and he's not a leader. He's just another politician.
Across town, Luciano dos Santos Silva's family is another story behind the statistics. His father, Marcos Antonio, passed away in April.
My father was always the pillar of the family, a person who helped others without wanting anything in return. He was the peacemaker. His death has been very painful, but I feel privileged to have a father like I did.
Luciano's a musician and keen member of the evangelical church in Brazil, like many of Bolsonaro's supporters. He doesn't pin the blame squarely on the president. He thinks all the politicians have played a part in Brazil's chaotic response to the pandemic.
Here in Brazil, COVID-19 is no longer about public health, it's about politics. Each person defending their own interests. There's no unit to bring the pandemic to an end.
Jair Bolsonaro and his supporters continue to focus on reopening the economy. Brazil can't stop, he says, time and time again. Brazilians need to get back to work. In the middle of the pandemic, many feel there's no leadership. Miguel Nicolelis is a neuroscientist who's helping hard-hit northeastern states tackle COVID-19.
When politicians face biology or challenge biology, biology wins by a huge margin, you know? When you try to challenge a little tiny virus like this with nonsense, with joking or making fun of it or, you know, not paying attention to it, you are going to pay a tremendous price. And now we see exponential curves exploding. You cannot even describe this.
Out with Bolsonaro, protesters chanted at the weekend. It's a call that's growing louder as the crisis worsens.
Katie Watson. Boneheaded. That's the assessment of the Australian tennis star Nick Kyrgios of an exhibition tournament organised by the world number one Novak Djokovic. The criticism came after four players and two coaches at that tournament in Serbia and Croatia tested positive for coronavirus. Our tennis correspondent Russell Fuller told me more.
This event has gone ahead with social distancing a complete afterthought, it would appear. The rules are different in various parts of the world, as we know, and it seems as if the authorities in Belgrade last weekend and in Zadar in Croatia this weekend were happy for a certain number of spectators to be watching the action. But as a result of some close interaction between the players, we had, first of all, Grigor Dimitrov, who reached the semi-finals of the US Open in New York last year, testing positive, having withdrawn after the opening day's play. His opponent, Borna Coric of Croatia, has also now tested positive. There are unconfirmed reports that two other members of the coaching staff of the various players have also tested positive. I've just been speaking to Novak Djokovic's agent, who says he's not yet been tested, but will be. She didn't put a time on exactly when that will happen.
Yeah, there was a picture of him just yesterday, I think, of him sitting next door to one of the people who's caught this. So it's not surprising that he and others are being tested. This does look, as you say, look relatively careless in terms of sports organisation. When it comes to other sports, what are they doing? Are they perhaps more rigorous in their preventative measures?
Well, all the other tournaments that have been played so far have been very rigorous. There have been matches in Florida in April, a series of events indoors in Germany at the start of May. There's an event called the Ultimate Tennis Showdown, which has gone off successfully over the last couple of weekends behind closed doors in the south of France. But here, the rules have been completely abandoned. We've had players giving each other high fives. There have been handshakes. There have been hugs. There have been parties. They were trying some limbo dancing, it looked like, in a nightclub in Belgrade at the end of the first leg of the tour last Sunday. They played football together, basketball together. They've been surrounded by a sea of fans, and you can only wonder how many other people might have been affected.
Russell Fuller. Still to come in this podcast, a revisiting an ugly chapter in Britain's past.
It was a very hostile environment. They were very rude, very ignorant. This man kept calling us monkeys.
We hear stories of how the first Caribbean migrants to the UK were treated when they arrived. A German financial technology company has admitted that more than $2 billion missing from its accounts probably never existed. Wirecard, whose business includes processing credit card payments, has been hit by allegations of accounting irregularities that were reported by the Financial Times last year. Our economics correspondent Andrew Walker reports.
The missing $2 billion was supposed to have been in accounts in the Philippines for use in managing Wirecard's Asian business. But the Central Bank of the Philippines says the money appears never to have entered the country's financial system. Last week, the firm's chief executive resigned and its auditor refused to approve last year's accounts. Now the company says the balances reported to be in the Philippines probably never existed. Wirecard is discussing its finances with its banks and is considering other steps to save the business, including selling off or closing down some operations. The company's share price has fallen by more than three quarters in less than a week.
More now on Saturday's terror attack here in the UK. It's been revealed that an American citizen was among the three people stabbed to death in a park in Reading, west of London. This morning, silence had been held in the town and at a secondary school in nearby Wokingham, where one of the three victims taught. Andy Moore reports.
Pupils and teachers came together in silence at James Furlong School to mourn the death of a much-loved teacher. There were tears and tributes to a man described as an inspiration to everyone he taught. A second man killed in the attack has been named as Joe Ritchie Bennett. Born in Philadelphia, he'd been living in the UK for about 15 years. His family said they had lost a brilliant and loving son. Civic and religious leaders from across Reading's multi-ethnic community have laid flowers at the scene of the incident. They said the attacker might have wanted to sow division, but the town was united in its grief. A suspect, 25-year-old Khairi Sadallah, is still being questioned by police. He is originally from Libya and was known to the security services, but wasn't considered to be a genuine risk or immediate threat.
Today in the UK is Windrush Day, which was created 2 years ago to honour members of the Caribbean community who came here to Britain to help rebuild the country after World War II. It's named after the ship which brought the first group across the Atlantic. Many of them experienced prejudice, and to commemorate the day they arrived, the Museum of London has released a selection of oral histories documenting the experiences of the Windrush generation and their descendants. The newsroom's Richard Hamilton reports.
The Empire Windrush brings to Britain 500 Jamaicans. Many are ex-servicemen who know England. They serve this country well.
In Jamaica, 72 years ago, the Empire Windrush passenger liner arrived at Tilbury Docks near London. But its passengers did not often get the welcome they'd been promised. Many of them experienced racial discrimination, finding it hard to get jobs and places to live. And their children were bullied at school because of the colour of their skin. This woman worked as a student nurse in a London hospital in the late 1960s.
They were very rude, very ignorant. They didn't know where Trinidad was. And then around the same time, this man who was in long-term kept calling us monkeys. How are your tree houses and how do you get up there? And one day he said something like that. Oh, he said, you black something to me. And I said, listen, I am sick of you calling me names. I am black. For 21 years, I know I'm black. So tell me something I don't know. And that changed everything for me and for him. He started to ask more decent questions. Mm. I ended up taking photo albums onto the ward.
These personal stories, recorded as interviews, provide an insight into their remarkable contribution to life in London and their resilience in the face of prejudice that lingers to this day. Their experiences are particularly poignant as the Black Lives Matter movement gathers pace across the world. Fatini Aravini is the digital curator at the Museum of London.
The Museum of London has a very rich collection of oral histories, almost more than 5,000 hours of recorded life stories. Oral histories offer a more personal perspective of the past and the everyday life.
These oral histories are often quite nuanced. For instance, the woman in the next recording recalls her memories of her parents' living room and what it said about her family.
No one was allowed to sit there unless it was when visitors came. We didn't really live up there. It was for show. It was the good room to show that this is how we really are. These are our values. We are nice people.
The Windrush scandal first came to light in 2017 when The Guardian newspaper reported that under the Home Office's hostile environment policy, some of the families of that generation had been threatened with deportation because they didn't have the right paperwork to prove they could stay in Britain. Although the government was subsequently forced to make a U-turn, the scars of that mistreatment are still felt today, something that Windrush Day and these oral histories hope to heal.
Richard Hamilton. The US motor racing organisation NASCAR says it's investigating after a noose was found in the garage stall of its only full-time black driver, Bubba Wallace. In a statement, Mr. Wallace called it a despicable act of racism that left him incredibly saddened. He's been a vocal advocate for the Black Lives Matter movement. It happened at the Talladega Superspeedway in Lincoln, Alabama. Michelle Martinelli is the NASCAR writer for USA Today and has more on the investigation.
Because of the COVID regulations put in place by NASCAR to try and obviously keep people safe while it continues to race, there's a relatively limited number of people allowed at the track. And so it's not as widespread as to who might have done such a heinous act. Bubba Wallace has been integral in leading NASCAR's commitment to change. He, along with several other big name drivers, including drivers like Dale Earnhardt Jr. and Jimmy Johnson, participated in a video expressing their commitment to listening, learning, and engaging as the first steps to fighting racism. And then not long after that, about 2 weeks ago, Bubba Wallace said that NASCAR needed to ban the Confederate flag. And less than 48 hours after he did that on national television, NASCAR banned the Confederate flag.
Michelle Martinelli. And to end this podcast, we look to the future, beyond the coronavirus pandemic. The BBC World Service is asking whether this could be a turning point, not just for individuals, but for whole societies. In a series called Rethink, we've asked an eclectic collection of contributors to tell us not what they predict will happen, but what they want to happen. Here, the South Korean Foreign Minister Kang Kyung-hwa tells us of the need for democracies to uphold the principle of accountability.
COVID-19 has tested the ability of governments to perform our most basic duty, which is to protect the safety and dignity of our peoples. For democracies, it has also tested our ability to do so while being faithful to our values. Foremost among these is accountability to the people, who give governments the responsibility and the power to govern. It is perhaps easy to brush this aside when struck by crisis, when there is little time and governments are pressed for immediate action. But in fact, crisis is a time for democracies to redouble our commitment to accountability. And the best way to do so is to be transparent. Full disclosure about what the government is doing or not doing in the midst of a crisis may be difficult, but it is all the more critical, for this is the only way to win the public's trust, which is the most important ingredient in effective crisis management. The public needs to be informed and assured that the government is doing its very best to serve them. In Korea, we have tenaciously stuck to this commitment from the very beginning of COVID-19. Every day, we have shared with the public what we know and don't know, what we are doing or not doing about the fast-spreading disease. And we did so based on science and evidence, continuously adapting our measures in line with the growing body of knowledge about this tricky virus. And we did so even at times when government action was falling short and faced with severe criticism. In turn, public trust in government generated civic participation in social distancing and civic activism in solutions that complemented government measures in testing, tracing, and treatment. A clear confirmation of this trust was the highest voter turnout in nearly three decades for the elections in mid-April. Crises tend to turn countries insular and reveal the weakest links in our societies. Across the world, COVID-19 has prompted governments to close borders and weakened the solidarity that is needed to overcome global challenges. Inside countries, it has exposed deep-seated inequalities, lacks in state capacity, the pitfalls of technology, and many more tough problems. Democracies must face up to these with honesty and humility and join forces for the dignity and safety of all of humanity. Only by doing so will we be stronger and better prepared to grapple with today's and tomorrow's challenges.
That was the South Korean Foreign Minister Kang Kyung-hwa. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast, perhaps you have your own ideas about how life should be after lockdown, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
Hey there. Are you a marketer on the fence about podcast advertising? Let Podsights help you. They believe in podcast advertising so much that they're running this message. Here's the deal. Podsights provides brands with data-driven insights on their podcast advertising. Not only that, they'll give you true ROI of your ad spend. Gone are the days with promo codes and vanity URLs. In fact, they aren't even going to give you one. Just go to podsights.com for more information.